It's interesting, not being a music director is in some ways vastly preferable because the responsibilities are totally different. As a guest conductor, you go in as a kind of hired gun to clean up Dodge. I mean, you go in with a specific program and you greet an orchestra frequently for the first time, and you don't have an already existing relationship with that orchestra. So from their point of view, hopefully that comes as a breath of fresh air. From your point of view, you're a kind of combination of Mr. Fix-It in a very limited amount of time and benefiting from the traditions of whatever orchestra it is you're visiting. So it's a very valuable and I think slightly preferable to being a music director experience. As music director, you're into administration so much of the time with certain incumbent, what would you call it, responsibilities of shaking hands and greeting the right people, et cetera, which you don't have to do as a guest conductor.
So you have this almost like masterclass experience when you go in to visit these orchestras.
In a way, although masterclasses, you're having us students of any sort coming and doing their stuff for you. Yeah, I guess from that point of view, it could be compared to that in that the orchestra plays the piece that you've brought along with you. And you try and mold it to the way you want it. I used to say to conducting students of mine, when they would be nervous about getting up in front of an orchestra, in the case of students, orchestra of their peers, who they've got to face over the lunch table the next day, don't be nervous because there's 95 people and there are therefore 95 different ways of approaching this piece. Someone's got to say, let's do it this way. That's your job. And that seemed to give them a kind of self-confidence to at least actually climb up on the podium and begin directing.
You've been at this a long time, and just sort of a follow-up to what you were talking about, this opportunity to go around to lots of different orchestras. Has the quality of orchestras grown in the few decades that you've been doing this, or have they stayed the same?
That's a very interesting question, and I could go on about it for hours, but I won't. First of all, there's no reason that any orchestra should not be terrific because the quality of the students coming out of the conservatories is getting higher and higher and higher. It's quite extraordinary from that point of view. The number of positions in any one orchestra that become available to audition for are precious few compared to that output from the colleges and universities. Therefore, those places are being filled by better and better and always better. I once said to a member of the orchestra here, talking about one player who needed to be replaced, to put it politely. And I spoke to him and I said, if there is someone better for the job, shouldn't they get it? And he kind of sorrowfully shook his head and said, there's always someone better out there. Which is true. So that's the other side of the same coin, is job security. And therefore, all orchestras are a combination of people that have been there a long time, and the incoming young blood is absolutely unabashed and undaunted by anything and just go and play their socks off. And you get an interesting disparity. Let me tell you a quick story. The Chicago Orchestra that plays in Grant Park. Concertmaster had been there years and years and years and years and years, and a young student got the job of assistant concertmaster. So he was actually sitting next to the concertmaster. He turned up for the first outdoor rehearsal about 45 minutes early to practice the part, all alone on the stage. Everyone else scraped in 2 minutes too. Eventually, the old boy sat next to him, and the young man, full of enthusiasm, pointed to a passage in the music and said, does the maestro like this very soulful and devastatingly emotional, or does he like it kind of clean and classical? And the concertmaster pointed to the music and said, white's the paper, blacks the notes, play the black. Which kind of shows you, but no, without doubt, there is an improvement, a wave of improvement inevitably going on and on.
What is it like coming back to an ensemble that you knew so well, you spent 15 years with? What's that experience like?
Coming back after 15 years is absolutely split into two, because you come in feeling you are a stranger, because you are visiting a part of your history that hasn't existed for that huge length of time. Within maybe 20 seconds of actually being there, you blink to think, has any time at all passed between now and when I was here? There's an extraordinary dichotomy between the two telescopic visions or feelings. First of all, it's wonderful to come back and be amongst colleagues that you know so well. You are instantly struck by the fact that they haven't changed a scrap, and you hope you haven't either. The old habits of, I mean, when you've been music director for a long time, and I think probably Jimmy Levine is a perfect example of this. He's been with the Met Orchestra for all those years. You develop shortcuts to rehearsal. You know what they're capable of. They know the way you like things, and it saves rehearsal time by the million. If you go to a new orchestra, there's more time spent on rehearsing, getting to know each other, basically. There's an absolute switch point when you're visiting a new orchestra, which is after the first break for coffee of rehearsal number one, everything is smooth sailing. There's that little sizing each other up that goes on in the very first section of the very first rehearsal. And I expected that to be so here in Hartford. Not a bit of it. We picked up exactly where we left off, and it was sheer pleasure from that point of view.
I'll just tell you, I talked to two musicians last night, and they both said that it was like old times. Yeah. Let's talk about your tenure at the Hartford Symphony. You were there from 1985 to 2000. What changed about that symphony from 1985 to 2000?
I think there was a lot of stirring of the pot in terms of the structure of the orchestra, the development office, how much financial gain could be made during that time, which was very slow at first. When you go in as a new music director, there's an initial enthusiasm on everyone. Everything is new, and you only have to look at the initial publicity of any new music director arriving somewhere to see that. But inevitably, after a while, it gets to be the status quo. And that's probably where the real hard work begins, because you can come in on a cloud of enthusiasm all round. Then you actually have to maintain that enthusiasm and visibility of the orchestra. I think the biggest changes probably were structural, in the sense that for the first time, the orchestra developed a core of 21 players that would be, quote, full-time professionals, not just per-service based throughout the year whenever they were required. And the formation of that so-called core orchestra led to us needing to find a series for that 21 group orchestra, chamber orchestra, to be employed, literally, physically. I came from a chamber orchestra background in London and was very eager to be able to do that kind of repertoire here with the 21 players, which one could increase if one needed to. To find a series for them to play, which was financially viable, was a brand new thing and had to somehow be funded and enthused about. And it was exactly that time that the Hartford Chamber Orchestra, which existed, was about to declare bankruptcy. And I got together with the board and management, and we decided almost within the first 5 seconds of that meeting that the Hartford Symphony Orchestra should take over that chamber orchestra management-wise, because they were the same players. And we did, and we created a brand new series which was based on the audience that we were attracting for the pre-concert talks of the main classical series with the big orchestra. because we found that we were attracting between 800 and 900 people per performance to a pre-concert talk. And as we were giving two performances of every program, that meant potentially 1,600, 1,800 people liked to be talked to as well as played to. And so we kind of took the pre-concert talk format of me sitting at the piano and illustrating what I was talking about to a slightly more visible level, whereby I had the versatility of being able to say to that audience, when Beethoven wrote this passage, turn around, conduct 16 measures of Beethoven, little did he know Gershwin was going to do exactly the same thing 200 plus years later, turn around, conduct the Gershwin. It was a wonderfully versatile medium. And that caught on, and I think the growth and the greater security of the core orchestra made the biggest difference to the nucleus of the larger orchestra. That was one of, I would say that's the biggest single change that took place.
Yeah, and those were called classical conversations.
That's correct, yes.
And so tell me, what was so appealing about those for the listener, for the concert goer?
I can't say what was appealing for them. I can only say what was appealing for me, which was since the year dot when I was given the biggest book I'd ever seen called The Oxford Companion to Music. I guess I was about 10 years old at the time, and I read that from cover to cover, and I still have that same copy, and I still go to it for certain. It has wonderful categories in it, like nicknamed symphonies, a whole category devoted to that, silly little things. And that instilled in me a burning desire to find out the surrounding circumstances of every piece of music, when it was composed, when it was first performed, what the composer was doing at the time, what the historical political situation was at the time, what the painting, what the artists of the period were doing, what the poets of a piece of music, unfortunately, is too often seen in total isolation. But it's part of an absolute web of interconnecting facets. And that has always fascinated me. So for me, the classical conversations were a chance to share my enthusiasm.
Did knowing what you know about these pieces and learning about the artist, as you say, inform your conducting?
Oh, I think so. That's a very, very wonderful question. I think it has to have done, just because it gives you a richer foundation when you're coming. I mean, learning a piece of music is learning black dots, blacks the music, black dots on a piece of white paper, which, I mean, when you think of the precision and technical perfection of what a piece of music on paper is, you look at it and you see a pitch, a dynamic, a tempo, an articulation, phrase marks, etc., which have to be, it's like a piece of graph paper in the building of a precision instrument. But what comes out is not a precision instrument per se. It's this warm, human, malleable, invisible product. And I think that warm, invisible product, if informed by a richer foundation of background, becomes literally more human. I really believe that. It's easy to plow through a piece from beginning to end like a machine. No problem at all.
And follow all the markings on the score and that type of thing.
And it's interesting because some composers, Mahler and Stravinsky in particular, are so precise and definite about what they put on paper. And even with Mahler, not just all those things I mentioned earlier in terms of detail, but he'll put an asterisk and a note at the bottom of the score saying, attention, conductor, make sure this happens and this happens and this happens. He's actually saying that in words. So he is, and Stravinsky are incredibly precise. Benjamin Britten too, said to someone, if you don't follow exactly what I wrote, I would rather you did not perform my music. I've taken years to try and perfect what I want. But then you come across a composer, say, who would be a good example, Dvorak, Brahms, thinking of the Romantic period, when liberties were taken with the written word, the written note, And that's, I think, where the historical background informs. I mean, think of Franz Liszt giving his piano recitals and women throwing their handkerchiefs at the piano, a kind of early Tom Jones, different garment, of course. A woman who was sitting in the front row received a fleck of perspiration from Liszt as he tossed his head at the end of a flamboyant passage, and rumor had it she didn't wash for the next 6 weeks. I mean, that sort of thing has to inform the way you perform Liszt.
It has to tell you that you have to play this with a lot of flair.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Obviously, it depends on the composer. You don't do that with Bach, admittedly, although as a chorus master once said to us when we were singing Bach with absolutely no vibrato, you know, they had babies in those days too. So, yeah, you've got to have it's the human element in music that most interests me.
Yeah. Let's talk about the works that you will be performing this weekend. And let's start with the Enigma Variations, because there is something about this title that suggests something cold or mathematical. But the music is anything but.
Oh, my God, yes. That's interesting you should say that, because the title and all the theories about what was the enigma, I mean, there are various theories which we needn't go into here, but never forget that Elgar was born into the Victorian era and lived through into the Edwardian era, when everything emotional was buttoned up and clamped down. Stiff upper lip of the British, empire growing, fly the flag, absolute, almost to show your emotion was considered rather risque and certainly unapproved of by ladies looking over their lorgnettes at you in surprise. Whereas burning inside Elgar is the same fire of emotion that burns in everybody, but it was always, for respectability reasons, covered over. And this is the absolute essence of his music. It is truly Edwardian. Little surprise that the way he could write music attracted the powers that be, and they said, I think this would be a good chap to compose a coronation march for when I'm king. So he had that kind of public stature of being able to write music for the civic occasion. But at the same time, he is the most sweet, gooey sentimentalist in the world, and the combination of that, those two, the respectability provides a kind of skeleton for the flesh that is burning within, and you get this extraordinary held down emotion. And when it does burst out, which of course it can do with great respectability in music, you get this overpowering sense of the man beneath the tweed waistcoat.
You also chose Bruckner's Third Symphony. As I recall, I was only here a few years when you left, but you were someone who programmed Bruckner on a regular basis. Is that right?
As often as I could.
Yeah. So
yes.
So tell me about your appeal, the appeal of Bruckner.
Again, it's the man, and you have to ask yourself the question: had Beethoven not been deaf, would he have composed the way he did? How much of his sheer manic frustration is poured into his music because of his physical difficulties of being shut off from the world orally? In the case of Bruckner, you've got a composer who, I would say, he is the most insecure composer of all the ones that we know. So lacking in self-confidence that he spent his entire life taking diplomas, examinations, tests to try and prove to the world that he was good enough to be a composer. He writes his first symphony, which is not number one. It just becomes an exercise in how to write a symphony, but it's fully formed and perfect. He then has the enough courage to write symphony number one, fully composed in every detail. He decides it's not good enough. So it's only the third symphony that he writes gets called number one. Then he writes number two, and which means that the third symphony that we're playing is actually the fifth that he wrote. Every photograph you see of him, he's clutching one of his diplomas. You see, I can compose. Look, here's the proof in my fist. Being born in a tiny village in Upper Austria of Ansfelden, he was a peasant. I mean, in the best sense of that word, in every sense of that word. And the fact that he had to go to Vienna, a city at the height of fashion, made him a total misfit. He found it incredibly difficult to get a foothold, musically speaking. So insecure was he that, although he never stopped composing, trying to get performances of his pieces, he would take a score along to a conductor. The conductor would look at it and say, well, maybe if you change this passage, we might consider performing it. He'd go back home and change it. So there comes this big dilemma of which version of which symphony do you do, because there are several of each. Hopeless socially. Had a heart. He was always falling in love with impossible girls. Didn't even have the courage to go up and speak to them. I mean, it was that sort of total unrequited love as from a distance. And yet he pours everything into the music. And the very first Bruckner I ever heard was this symphony, actually, the third, in London, conducted by Bernard Haitink, who is a great Brucknerian. And I'd never heard anything like this before in my life. It Bruckner's way of building a symphony, he is without doubt the most architectural of composers. He builds in sound huge edifices which resemble physically cathedrals. And he was an organist. And coming from his peasant background into Vienna, he went via the Abbey of St. Florian, just outside Linz, in Austria. The most Baroque splendor you've ever seen in terms of a chapel. He became organist there, and that's where he built these incredible acoustical structures on the organ initially. And at that very first performance conducted by Haitink, as it got towards the end, I knew he was going to bring back the theme from the very beginning, an hour earlier, which is in the minor key and therefore doleful, solemn. I knew he was going to bring it back at the end of the whole symphony in the major, bright and triumphant. And the next thing I knew, when it got to that point that I had foreseen, it was inevitable, the next thing I knew was a hand grabbing my shoulder, pulling me and saying, sit down, sit down. And in my excitement, I had actually stood up at that moment, totally unaware of where I was. Since that moment, I've been absolutely sold on Bruckner.
I really just have one more question, but if there's anything else you want to discuss before I do that, anything else? We've covered a lot of
I think we've done a lot. Yeah,
good. So Michael, what music are you listening to these days? What's grabbing your fancy these days?
Everything. Sponge is what I am as far as great music is concerned. But I'll tell you something interesting, which fascinates me, and I don't know the answer to it, except that I think it's what we've been talking about of the music is the man. You feel when the real inner emotions of the composer come out in musical form, it's so overpowering. And yet we are all trained musicians, and we go through our conservatories and we learn everything step by step by step. And in a way, like Elgar is locked into his tweed waistcoat, we are locked into academia from a musical education point of view. And if I know I'm going to hear a piece of music, like at a concert, or even a recording that I put on at home, I know I'm going to be listening with critical ears. That's the way I've been trained. It's my job. I cannot switch that off. So you listen, in a way, unemotionally, if you know what it is you're going to be listening to. But if music creeps up on me unexpectedly, it is so devastatingly powerful. It sneaks in because I haven't got my critical ears all ready for the concert. So therefore, I'm probably moved mostly by things like WNPR when I'm driving. I love to, as I go through the various stations, put on 89.90 FM, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Invariably, I'll catch a piece halfway through. And sometimes I will think, no, I don't want to listen to that now, and I'll change channel. But if something grabs me, and first of all, there's the obvious intrigue of what is this I'm listening to halfway through the third movement of whatever it is. So there's a guessing game, which is huge fun. But emotionally speaking, I can be bowled over by something, even if it's the most familiar piece in the world. Hearing it unexpectedly is the greatest joy. Now, that may sound quirky from a professional musician, but it's true.
No, I totally understand it, because when you're sitting down, you have chosen something that you want to listen to, and in this situation, you're being surprised by something.
Exactly, and it's that element of surprise that, for me, is probably the most exciting physical, oral experience I can think of. But in terms of what do I listen to, what do I choose to listen to these days, which is anything new. I'm intrigued to find out where the next Beethoven is going to come from. Anything that is not simply imitative. Let me try that again. Anything that is not simply imitative. I can't say. Shit. Forget it.
Yeah.
As long as a piece of music doesn't repeat what has already been composed at an earlier time and dresses it up in a new name, it has to be original, and yet it has to be able to stir those same basic elemental emotions within one. And I'll always listen to any of the greats anytime. And for me, two particular favorites, I guess, at Desert Island Disc Time, would have to include Bruckner and Janáček. And again, there's Janáček. I mean, another soul rather ill-equipped for everyday life, but composing this most glorious music.
Michael Lancaster, thank you so much.
Thank you.